Hello and welcome to episode 2 of That Sports Merch Podcast with myself, Lee Hyde, and my co-host, Matt Hudson. How are you, Matt?
Well, good, Lee. Not so bad at all. How are you?
Yeah, good. Good. We've had some great feedback on episode 1 with Robbie. Good to be back in the studio for episode 2.
It has, yeah. And really excited about what we've got coming up across the rest of the season, and some really interesting tales to be told across each of the episodes, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Today, we're going to talk to Nicole Beckers. She is the founder of FC88, and it's a new content topic for us, which I'm quite excited about. Obviously, we've touched on sustainability in a couple of conversations that we had in series one, but this is a real deep dive into sustainability and what clubs can be doing to widen their efforts in terms of pushing the sustainability needle, but also really resolving a big problem that a lot of clubs have that maybe they don't realize they have until they kind of peel back the surface a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. And I think sustainability in other sectors has very much been on the agenda for a while, hasn't it? But perhaps, sport is kind of playing a little bit of catch up. And this, it sounds like, this is a potential solution to some of those problems.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that sport has some work to do. And often sustainability within professional sports clubs is leveraged at non-consumer facing elements, things like energy usage and rainwater consumption and, using that to kind of water the pitches and that kind of stuff. So I think the consumer facing sustainability solution, which we're going to obviously talk to Nicole about, is an interesting one for sure.
Definitely. And it feels like it's appealing to a generation of supporters who perhaps aren't always considered in some of these decisions as well.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think Gen Z have a lot to do with pushing the needle in terms of what we're about to talk about. And I think it's a genuine opportunity for clubs to both widen their retail collections, but also to be doing the right thing and, to really be investing in somewhere and some focus that needs that attention. Without further ado, let's jump in.
But first, let's hear from our official podcast sponsor, StreakerSports.com.
StreakerSports.com is the proud sponsor of That Sports Merch Podcast. Bringing creative collaborations, we're the home of unique, heritage-inspired apparel celebrating the culture of sports. Our licensed collections include iconic brands such as Peanuts, Wiffle Ball, and Zamboni. Organizations like USA Hockey and USA Lacrosse. Sports personalities like Dick Vitale and Bill Raftery, as well as 40-plus colleges and universities. Our defunct league collections revive forgotten professional sports leagues of years past, bringing some incredible logos back to life. Check us out at StreakerSports.com. And for a limited time, only for That Sports Merch Podcast listeners, use the checkout code SPORTSMERCH15 to get 15% off site-wide. StreakerSports.com.
So today we're joined by Nicole Beckers, founder of FC88. FC88 are the upcycle partner to the football industry, working together with clubs, brands, and federations to essentially upcycle old football apparel, additionally driving sustainability and eradicating legacy stock problems. But a little more about that later as we dive into the detail. Nicole, perhaps you could just introduce yourself to our listeners and kind of give a little bit of detail around FC88.
Sure, no problem. So my name is Nicole. I've been working in the football industry, I think, for the last 14 years, always on the commercial side. So for a long time at the Dutch Football Federation, I was head of the commercial department over there, managing the partnership with Nike and all the major brands. And actually, that's also where my journey started with the kit and upcycling. And the story there was just in 2017, the national men's team didn't qualify for the World Cup in Russia. And I just asked a very simple question to my colleagues in kit management, like, "But we ordered this product 2 years in advance. I'm sure we're not going to get everything right." And then there was a long silence from the colleagues and like, "Yes, we're going to get all of it." But we didn't have any means to all the product because we weren't not going to the World Cup. And that was my first, getting more familiar with the end of life cycle and the life destination of all the apparel we had at the Federation, which was basically storage for the first 6 to 12 months and then incineration or shredding. And in core, I'm just a major football fan. So I couldn't really let that go. I came back frustrated back home. And that's where my journey started of, okay, what can we do with old kit if it can't be a kit anymore, if we can't give it away, if we can't donate it, if we can't reuse it or sell it anymore. And that's where I founded FC88, referencing to 1988 with the only European championship win ever by the Dutch team. They played the most finals, but also lost the most. But that 88 jersey, of course, was iconic. And for me, it represents that a football jersey is so much more than just polyester and a design and a sponsor logo.
Yeah, absolutely. That emotion and the empathy and all the feelings that a football fan gets from, you know, what is essentially quite a simple polyester garment. But no, it's really interesting to hear what prompted that kind of light bulb moment of, you know, we really need to do something about this problem. Because if it's, you know, how many federations, for instance, don't qualify for a major tournament, so, you know, surprisingly, I mean, I think Italy have been in that space over the last few years as well. And, you know, these clubs won't anticipate not qualifying. So it does create this mountain of apparel and other items. As you say, you know, a lot of people outside of the football world and the commercial sphere within the football world probably don't have any concept of this is a major issue, and it's happening not only in federations, it's happening in clubs where they don't have a great season or they get relegated from the top tier and they've ordered a minimum order requirement, which normally happens with a lot of major brand supply contracts, and they get stuck. You know, all they can, the traditional methods have been slice the price and try and sell as much as you can whilst you can. And then, as you say, incineration of goods. In terms of those early stages and that early concepting that you did for the business, was there anybody else involved alongside you? Was there anybody that you kind of spoke to and it really kind of hit home with them and said, I want to be on that journey with you? Or has it been you kind of fighting a solo fight for quite some time?
No, I'm a team player, so I love getting people involved in ideas, in concepts. I was flying solo in the first 2 years, and just because I had this light bulb moment myself, it was very practical in every day. When I went to the office, I was confronted with this problem, but it was only when I talked to friends who were working in sports marketing, and I was zooming out with them like, okay, this is the Dutch FA, but a club gets a new kit every season. And everything that the team has worn, from training gear to staff apparel, apart from the whole retail side, even if you zoom out and you take the, I don't know, 900 plus football clubs, professional clubs in Europe, this is a massive, massive, massive problem. And when I was talking to other federations or even the brands, so I was talking with Nike, of course, about this topic as well, none of them had a solution. None of them had, but we're working with this company doing this and helping us. Like, the only thing that came up was, of course, the retro jersey platform, you know, the classic football shirts type of companies, but still they can't sell anything, everything. You know, there's still those just regular black training tops with the logo on there. Or this was a second realization. If you change kit supplier, if you change main sponsor, then everything from last season, you, even if it's good, even it's new brand in the bag, you can't use it anymore. So when I was talking to people about my frustration, I saw that one, nobody had a solution. And two, the problem was way bigger than I even thought before when I just was focusing on the Dutch FA.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. There's a lot that can happen in, you know, a sports club environment or a brand or a federation for that matter, where it kind of escalates that problem. So many clubs are rebranding nowadays, you know, a slight tweak or change to their club identity. And suddenly it used to frustrate me as a retailer when clubs and brands kind of potentially know about those branding changes 2 years out, consultation periods, design periods. And as a retailer, you're still buying product with that current brand on. And suddenly you get told that, actually, in 6 months' time, we're launching this brand and you've done your seasonal buy.
You got your 3 to 6 month sell-off period, but then it's worthless. Well, it's not worthless for the fan, but for the, in commercial sense, you can't reuse it anymore.
No, absolutely. No, I sympathize with that. And, you know, it's definitely a huge issue. And I'm sure a lot of people are identifying with this and relating to it and thinking, there isn't an answer. I've just got this stockpile of product, but hopefully, now FC88 are offering a a partnership and a service and an operation that gives these clubs and brands and federations a new opportunity, should we say, you know, a new way of thinking about things, a new way to breathe additional life into extinct products, should we call it? You know, there's so many terms for it, dead stock, overstock, you know, all of these key phrases within the industry. So you're headquartered in the Netherlands, but I see that you've also expanded quite quickly into local operations within certain European territories. How do you decide in terms of, is it the size of the opportunity in terms of where those new operations go? And also, what advantage does that give both you as a business, but also the clients that you're potentially working with in that territory?
So apart from making new product from old apparel, we found it was very, very important for us to make it by hand and as local as possible. Because, you know, we can make beautiful stuff from a jersey, but we have to ship it to China, then, you know, it doesn't feel authentic and real. So we started out with a Portugal studio, actually. That was where we launched. Because you can imagine there's not really anyone doing this already in sports, luckily for us. But also, that was the biggest challenge the last 3 years was finding the right partners locally. So we started out in Portugal. And then we opened up in Rotterdam in the Netherlands, which we wanted because there we can do some R&D work and testing and et cetera. And then the next step was quite quickly, okay, the UK market is the biggest market for us. So we have to have a local studio from two main reasons. One being the locally produced product and the claim we're making on being a more sustainable solution than the solution currently. But secondly, also a practical one because of Brexit. And branded product being moved across the border, that's just expensive. It takes a long time. So it was both of those reasons that we opened a studio in Brighton, where there's a lot of textile innovation and going on, a good place for us to be. And the next studio will be opened in France, again, also because of the market. We're not really aiming on having a studio in each country, but we want to have a good reach in the European market with everything above Paris going to Rotterdam at the moment, south of Paris goes to Porto. France would be sensible because the French market is also big. And then we're going to open the next one in Eastern Europe to be as local as possible in production as well.
Yeah, trying to cover as many bases as possible. I guess, you know, there's the carbon footprint of all of this that is to be considered as well. And you're right, you know, shipping everything off to China is not only expensive, but, you know, when you think of the kind of environmental impact, and that has a massive role to play in your messaging and your brand as well. So
absolutely. And we also see, by the way, that we are football fans. So when it's been made by local people who really feel something with club or with the clubs or with football, or, you know, you got this local sense of community involvement as well, that wasn't really on the forefront when we started out, but it's now very valuable. And I've got one nice anecdote. So in our Rotterdam studio, there's a lot of refugees from Syria and Iraq who were tailors back in their home countries, came to the Netherlands and had to find a new job and a sense of purpose, basically. And I had this one story from a guy who makes product for us there. And he worked for one of the biggest clubs in Europe. Unfortunately, I can't really say yet who that is. But his son, who was 11, a big football fan, he came to him because his dad showed him what he was working on in the studio. And he was so proud of his dad. And his dad, in his turn, was so proud of that his son was proud of him, you know, bringing him to a different country on the other side of the world, starting over, and then having this feeling of purpose. Not only I'm making money, but I'm doing something that has a purpose and that's cool and my son likes it because it's one of the big football clubs he's fan of. It makes it a very good story and a very positive impact from that point of view.
Yeah, that's incredible. You can't factor that value into your business. You know, that's just an amazing byproduct of what you're doing. So in terms of the local studios, so what facilities do you look at in terms of a partner? What does it look like inside of that studio? They're obviously manufacturing products. They're taking old product in and turning that into new products. So there's a lot of manufacturing that goes on. Are there other kind of core components that happen locally as well?
The fun part is all three studios are very different from where they started out. So in Brighton, it was a repair studio, which they were repairing clothing and that kind of stuff. And together with us, we trained their staff in making our products. in Portugal is a sustainable merchandising company who wanted to add upcycling to their portfolio as well. And in Rotterdam, it's a social studio. So it's different from where we started out with them, but they all make the same product now. And what we try to do is we try to reuse as much of the apparel we get in. We started out with jerseys, but at the moment we're working with shorts and jackets and socks and scarves and basically anything that's left and which we creatively think we can make something of more value from. And then we try to use and reuse old stadium banners for the inside. We try to reuse car seats as the, you know, the buckle, the straps. So I think at the moment, 70-75% of the ingredients in a new product are old items recycled and reused. Sometimes we have to use new recycled padding for a type of bag, but we try to, you know, decrease that as well. And then the practical side, and I really love being in the studios because you get the jersey in, you see people actually, you know, drawing with chalk a pattern on the jersey or short and cutting it by hand with the scissors and then stitching it together in each piece individually. So it's really a craftsmanship that goes on in those studios, and it's all handmade, and therefore each piece is also different from the last one because it's manufactured by hand.
Yeah, and again, I think when consumers look at product like this, that they're often looking at price points and thinking, well, that's quite expensive for what was an old football jersey. But I think it's really easy to overlook the journey that product has been on and the skill set that's required in terms of the, you know, the staff literally hand making these new products, hand cutting, hand stitching, you know, really, as you mentioned there, it is an incredible skill set and something that the people doing that have trained for years in terms of being able to kind of hone those skills. So I think whilst, yes, the product on the shelf in a retail store may look expensive or at the top end of the market, the appreciation for what's gone into that product is what's needed at that point and how unique it is as well.
Yeah. And I also try to argue with clubs often, and this is an interesting discussion, and we try to discuss it with open visor. You know, we're very transparent. So is often a club says, okay, if I'm going to buy, if I'm going to make something upcycled and it costs me 20 quid to make £20, well, then I have to resell it for £65 and that's too expensive. And I'm like, but do you have to resell it for £65? And that's an interesting discussion, of course, because often if they buy bulk, generic, mono-branded merchandise shop somewhere in the Far East in a big container, it costs them £5-6 to make, and then they can 3-4 times 400% margins on that. That's the business model. And I try to discuss, is it necessary to have a 300% margin on the product, or is a very decent 100-150% margin also good if you have these extra values, the story to tell, the positive impact? And of course, I know football is a money machine, and it's big business. I know that. I've worked on that side as well, but I every time I try to start this discussion, because you can't have a good comparison between the two, because it's completely different who made it, where it's been made, which quality, which eye to detail, etc. It's so different from a generic bum bag and an upcycled one, for example.
Yeah, I think you make an interesting point there. Yes, clubs have their pricing matrix for bulk product, you know, right from jerseys to pencil cases and footballs and soft toys and, you know, all different manner of things. But ultimately, the club and the retail department will be looking to make a certain net margin across their whole business, you know, what's referred to as a blended margin, you know, take the margins of everything and look at that. But you're right, when it comes to this product category, I think clubs, brands, whoever's reselling it, they need to understand that not only is this unique product, there's a lot more that goes into the manufacturing of it. It's not, you know, you're not on a highly automated production line churning out 300-500 at a time of the same thing. But also, I think the other thing that's important that they need to appreciate is what this opportunity has also resolved for them. You know, that big mess of boxes that were going nowhere, that were going to be put in a fire, or that were going to be, you know, no doubt part of it will have been donated to fantastic charities like Kit Aid in Africa. And there's always things that don't fit that donation method, or they just can't sell through the volume and that they can't clear it, there is always stuff left. And this is the solution to eradicating that problem, or certainly helping to make that problem as small as possible. And I think some appreciation for the product that comes out at the end compared to what the problem was at the start lends itself to, actually, this is, you know, taking the category as a whole, it's probably a very small category in terms of the overall makeup of the, you know, of all of the collections of the retail business. Surely there's a trade-off in terms of, yes, it's expensive to make, your margin isn't going to be as much on this product, but look at what it's taken away as a problem. You know, what was the value of all of that product that was going to get put in a fire?
And it costs some money to put that in storage. It costs some money to destroy it as well. It is absolutely a niche market and a niche target group. But the fan who wants to buy that also appreciates it. And it's okay for them to buy, I don't know, a bum bag for 35, 40 quid, because they know it's a unique piece and it showcases their, you know, commitment to the club, but maybe also to the environment and the world in a different way. It's not a product for everybody because, of course, yeah, it's different than a generic 15 quid bum bag.
Sure. And do you think kind of the Gen Z and the younger, more focused consumer on sustainability is going to drive that further in the future? Do you think that...
And 100%.
That natural desire for reused, repurposed, you think that's only going to get bigger in terms of that, you know, that they'll almost be expecting their clubs to be taking those steps.
So the first step often was what retail did was the bio cotton or the recycled polyester. But I think especially that generation, they're educated and they know that, you know, recycled polyester sometimes doesn't mean it's a better choice in the long run. And I'm not an expert on that, but just from based on my experience and knowledge. But yeah, there is this very interesting group of more consumer conscious on the environment who wants to buy product that's not bad for the environment. And we see in our data, so when a club sells their product, we often try to get some input in from who bought it and what are the RRPs that you're using to then educate ourselves, but also educate the next club or federation we're working with or brand. So the core group is 18-30 who buys the product. And it's across male and female because it's not the standard football kit or jersey that you wear, you know, a very cool bum bag or a very nice backpack. You can use it to go to the office or to school or university or anything. So it taps into a bit of a different market, which is also a group who often wants to pay a little bit more for a unique, premium, bespoke item.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'm sure there's a lot of learning still to take as you start building those data sets from more clients coming on board. I read a frightening stat that on average there's 4 million units of team and federation sports apparel destroyed annually. What kind of things have you experienced in terms of your findings when you've obviously peeled back the surface and you've explained what the catalyst was for this idea in terms of the Dutch Football Federation? But I'm sure you have many conversations with many clubs and I'd imagine the first point of call is, what's the size of the opportunity? What are we dealing with here? What kind of things have you experienced? Obviously, you don't need to name names. I appreciate some of it's, you know, confidential to the industry, but what kind of, I won't say horror stories, but what have you found when you've really looked at some of these new clients coming on board or had those early kind of conversations?
The very first reply often is, I don't think we have a problem, but let me check. And that's the first call and that's the first meeting. And then the second one is, they're falling off their chairs and flabbergasted. I didn't know we had product going back 4 years in an external unit we rent for every month. And so basically what the first realization is, what I didn't know, and I was responsible back then already for 8 years for the Nike partnership, but I wasn't aware of this problem. That's what's still going on in the industry. So a partnership team, an account manager on the commercial side, they're responsible for product going in, and that's it. Going in and getting the old out of sight as soon as possible. But the responsibility for that end of life destination, it lies with a kit manager or someone who just feels involved and says, well, I know a good program where I can donate it to. And like you mentioned, there's always product left because, of course, they also got to pick and choose the best jerseys and, well, socks I can't use and I've got too many shorts and, you know, so there's always product left. So that was the first, still the fact is that not enough people within the club know and then take responsibility for end of life. And secondly is my own estimations were way too low. If you see from also a little bit of the fast fashion influence is that a club gets more and more kid in, right? There's a third kid and a fourth kid. And I'm not the expert here, but if I'm believing the people working at the brands, the real innovation in, you know, fabric, etc., it's every 4 to 5 years. So there's not really a need of a new kid every year if you don't change sponsor and your home jersey stays the same. What Brentford, of course, did, they used the jersey 2 times over at the home and away. So it's absolutely a volume-based business model that drives this volume into the market. Last year, we did some work together with UEFA on their circular economy guidelines for football apparel. And we did the research and we interviewed clubs and federations on their end-of-life use, etc. And we found that between 45 and 105 million euros worth of wholesale value will be destroyed each season.
That's a frightening figure, isn't it? Bearing in mind that's wholesale value. You know, when people are listening to this and they're not within the clubs, that wholesale value is the price that the clubs will pay the brand or the distributor in terms of accessing that product for their use and their sale. So that's naturally much less than the retail price that a consumer will see. I mean, if you put that into consumer pricing, you're looking at
100, 250 million, somewhere between that. That was also, I think, getting the confirmation that this is a big problem across the board. And there are some good examples of mostly smaller clubs who are having a good system in place where, you know, the team kit, silk, if the team doesn't use it, it goes into retail and being sold. But often, of course, you got the promo kit and you've got the retail jersey. So it's different jerseys as well. And then the brands don't want to have the promo shirt, so the one that the player wears. They don't want that in retail because it's a more premium product, a more expensive. So the confirmation is there, the market is there, the interest is there. And I think one of the other things is that, yes, sustainability is a very big buzzword, often very difficult for a football club to make it tangible and relevant to fans. And we find this, we could be a missing puzzle piece, a piece of the puzzle for a club to make it tangible and to make it relevant for a fan, how they work on being a more sustainable club.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely an extension of other areas of the business that they're looking at sustainability. And like you say, not many of those will cross over with fans. So it'll be things like, you know, their energy consumption and, you know, rainwater, reusing rainwater systems and that kind of thing, which if, as much as they can, you know, put that into documentation and put it into kind of diligence in terms of trying to become more sustainable.
We'll be right back with the interview after this quick ad from our official podcast sponsor, Streaker Sports.
StreakerSports.com is the proud sponsor of That Sports Merch podcast. Bringing creative collaborations, we're the home of unique, heritage-inspired apparel celebrating the culture of sports. Our licensed collections include iconic brands such as Peanuts, Wiffle Ball, and Zamboni. Organizations like USA Hockey and USA Lacrosse. Sports personalities like Dick Vitale and Bill Raftery, as well as 40-plus colleges and universities. Our defunct league collections revive forgotten professional sports leagues of years past, bringing some incredible logos back to life. Check us out at StreakerSports.com. And for a limited time, only for That Sports Merch podcast listeners, use the checkout code SPORTSMERCH15 to get 15% off site-wide. StreakerSports.com.
Like you say, there's not much that, as an outside fan, you feel, how can I make my club become more sustainable? How can I help my club become more sustainable? Whereas, you know, this turning old products into new and those new products being available to the consumer market, that really is a kind of link between those, probably a fan's frustration that I want to do more and a club's opportunity to kind of allow the fans to start contributing to the sustainability of that club. So no, it joins a lot of pieces and it ticks a lot of boxes for sure. You've got quite an illustrious list of clients from some of the biggest teams in world football across Europe to leading global sports brands. You've referenced Nike there and some of the work that you've done. And and obviously the Dutch Football Federation. You've built up quite a reputation in a short space of time. I think FC 88 is quoted as been started in 2020. So, you know, you're on a quick rise and quite a young business. I'd imagine you get a lot of approaches having such a unique offering, you know, such a niche offering that there's hardly anybody else doing this. I know that there's a couple of brands in America kind of doing the same with a lot of the universities and colleges and pro sports in America. But is it clubs coming to you? Is it more inbound than you trying to drive that message outbound? And do you think that is as a result, if so, of them wanting to become more consciously sustainable?
I think outbound is basically more getting a spotlight on the problem still. Like you mentioned, we're still quite young, really been going for the last 3 years. And the topic is still so difficult for a lot of clubs to grasp. So that's the outbound. But yeah, inbound is very specific clubs saying, hey, we heard about your solution. We have this problem. We just switched from New Balance to Adidas. The New Balance sell-off period is finished. We now want to reuse it. And the cool thing is with upcycling, we leave the New Balance logo off and you get the fabric as the thing to work with. So yeah, we really see a big momentum of inbound. And it's because also we try to be active on the socials and showcase what we do, but also tell why we're doing it. And I think that's always two parts of our story. It's one, reusing of the apparel that you normally would destroy. And secondly, handmade, locally made, because for us, that would be one of the USPs on the long term. But of course, you know, brands are going to do this, hopefully with us together. And if we have this network of studios across the world where we can make it locally in a good way, then we hopefully will be the partner that they turn to.
Yeah, sure. Education is critical, I would imagine, in terms of not only the business growing, but I think probably business growth probably comes second in terms of what you're, you know, as much as everybody aspires to grow a business, you know, and has their kind of ambition in mind. I can see from talking to you and the reaction that certain words and certain phrases get, education is the critical component here and really trying to drive that understanding within clubs, some of who can be very traditional. I know in the UK, a lot of club structures and ownership and operations can be very traditional. It's always been done this way. This is the way we do it. We don't have a problem kind of turning a blind eye to a mountain of stock that's building. And I can only imagine the conversations that you have in terms of that education piece, trying to break down those boundaries that you're not, yes, you're offering a service and yes, there's a price to pay for that service, but you're not actively trying to batter them with a sales pitch all the time. You're actually trying to educate them and help them on their sustainability journey in terms of, you know, what the end looks like, not what the problem at the start looks like and how much it's going to cost to get to the end. It's more around the bigger issue. I get that feeling.
We're also very much self-aware, right? So we're not Greenpeace. We're not going to batter them with, hey, you're doing it wrong. But also, the best solution is textile recycling. That's not in place for the next 5 to 10 years, probably. So we're the better solution, a more sustainable solution than that's the solution that's currently out there. And yes, it's about telling why it's important and what's the value for them. So it's not just potential commercial value. It's the PR value. It's brand value for them and their sponsors, because they're going to get to reuse apparel that normally nobody would see anymore. And now it's getting reused. And maybe the next 2 to 3, 4 years, that product, that bag or hat is used by the fans. So we try to combine it as a value proposition rather than a sales pitch, because yeah, I know that we're not cheap and we don't win it on being an easy, quick win on the commercial side. We win it on being a good solution for a problem. And because we put this message up in front and front and center, if we talk to clubs or if we go to conferences or where else we're talking, we see that now the last 12 months, clubs come back to us, which we, you know, spoken with 3 years ago. The topic wasn't really relevant back then, or wasn't a possibility back then. And now they came back like, yeah, your message stuck with me. And now we're working on the topic. And can we have a look at how we can collaborate? So we also feel that, yeah, by telling the story, we, in the end, put a spotlight on ourselves also.
Yeah, it's that slow realization, I guess, from clubs that actually, do you know what they were speaking about 3 years ago is right. We do need to be better at this, and we need to start looking at new solutions. I read that you've recently signed a licensing agreement with the Dutch Football Federation, which is quite unique in that you're technically their upcycle partner for the foreseeable duration of the license. So what does that, because obviously I understand licensing agreements in general in merchandising and retailing and supply. What does that partnership look like in terms of kind of, if you can allude to anything that's included in it, but what commitments are there on both sides, I guess?
So we are often a very strange partner in the whole licensing and retail side, right? So we don't have any virgin product ourselves. We work with everything that the club has already left in storage. So with the Dutch FA, what we've done is throughout the year, kit becomes obsolete because, you know, there's a wrong print on there, or a player is retiring and his apparel can't be used, or next month the new kit comes out for Europeans. And we said to them, okay, if we can create this upcycle scheme throughout the year, and we upcycle at the moment, every time that there's a piece of the stock becomes available, we upcycle it, then you don't have massive stock at the end of each year, and you get to choose what you want to use it throughout the year. So for example, we have an upcycling scheme, and that means we create from their Christmas gifts to sponsorship giveaways to a fan collection. And throughout the year, we have, well, basically every month there's a collection being produced. And when the new kit comes out, there's not a big bulk left, but every piece that became obsolete already was upcycled back into something new. The beauty of that, apart from being a very lean and mean operation, is also they have involved their sponsors. And that's a very good step, I think. So from ING to Nike to KPN, Heineken, they then buy upcycled product with us from the old kit that, you know, we have here from the Dutch FA, and then they use it in their partnership activations, their internal events, their giveaways to stakeholders, etc. And for us, it's important to make sure that we create unique gifts for partners, so that not everybody gets, I don't know, a washback, for example. But it also involves them in this theme of sustainability.
Yeah, that's a great angle on it. Actually, clubs will be looking at predominantly what can they put into their retail channel and what can they sell, but there's a much wider opportunity here in terms of those club partners that featured on the kit. And obviously every club hosts to differing levels dependent on the size of their club, you know, hundreds of hospitality guests and experienced guests throughout this, well, each game, but throughout the season as well, where they're looking for unique guests. Maybe they want to kind of reward their seasonal, the guys who are committing to their executive boxes or lounges on a seasonal basis with a nice gift. And, you know, you're not going to get something more unique than an upcycle product.
And the, and those senior board members have 15 jerseys already in their closet, right? So you have to, and especially if you can give them something that's not for sale, though the money can buy experience there, it really adds value to them as well. So for us, it's really a B2B focused and a B2C focused collection, which are different type of products, different price points. And that makes for the volume we can create for them, so that basically almost every item they have left over is being upcycled in the end.
And imagine that's something that you can use in what you've done historically with other clubs or federations. You can then go into a new club and kind of present both of those opportunities as well. So it's a much wider piece than just here's a collection of six retail items that we could, you know, take, I don't know, X thousand amounts of units and create, you know, 500 of these and 300 of those. And
in the end, our goal is to have more of those longer term upcycling partnerships, because the impact is way bigger. Of course, if you can work throughout the year with the same club and make sure that they don't destroy anything that's not, you know, reused anymore.
I think the other win there on in terms of the gifting and the kind of sponsorship and partnership piece as well is there's no markup. That kind of takes the pricing issue out of the way. You know, they'll have a budget for this kind of gifting and this kind of hospitality and entertaining and things. And
yeah, it's the easier side of the business, I must say.
Sure. Yeah, I can imagine. But I'd imagine there's a few commercial directors probably listening to this now thinking, yeah, I need to have that conversation. I've never really thought about that. That's such a cool idea.
And then we're often even a cheaper option than buying, again, a branded set of AirPods for a senior a sponsorship director or a laptop sleeve that he already has 10 back at home with a club logo.
Yeah, sure. There aren't many organizations, we've touched on it, you're quite niche. There aren't many organizations kind of offering what you guys offer. Why do you think that is? Do you think that you guys have seen the issue from the inside, you're more switched onto it and you're ahead of the curve? Or do you think that it's just truly specialized and that people have maybe looked at doing this and kind of gone through the concepting piece at the start and actually just given up because it's just far too complex?
I think it's a combination of both. I think we're still quite early. When we started out 3 years ago, we really had to explain what upcycling was. That's not necessary anymore. So yeah, there is some more educated people in the sports industry in general that gets it. But I think also because it's not easy. It's easy to make a bucket hat, right? So you have a pattern, you cut it out, you sew it back together with a piece of cotton and you've got a bucket hat. But what we try to do as well is specialize in those premium bespoke items like a backpack, fully circular, made from banners and jersey and car seat belts and everything up. And that's difficult to do. But also, I think another difficulty is the volume, because you have to have studios who can make this by hand in a price point that's still interesting for a club to buy in, and also try to have your own business case up and going. We always say our margins are not big, so we have to have those volumes to be there. But we fully believe that in the long term, that the studio network we're building, that gives us a big edge on potential competitors. And still there will be those very cool, and we support them, local initiatives with a local studio and a local club doing what we do, hopefully a little bit more creative and not copying things, but making their own product. That's perfect. That's good. The market is is big enough for all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And is there, I guess this question's twofold. When you speak to a club initially and you identify that they've got an issue and yes, they want to commit to a collection and a partnership, is there a size the problem has to be to make it work, if that makes sense? Can people have not enough stock in order to kind of make a suitable collection? And then additionally, with these local studios that you're working with, can they, if the problem is too big, can they be vastly overwhelmed? You know, is there a capacity in terms of what you can feasibly do at the minute in terms of your partnerships?
Yeah. So from your first question on less problem, we try to have low MOQs to get clubs involved, because we see once a club has one of our bags on their desk in the office, people get it, you know, people see it, get it and want it. And okay, where did you buy that? And can I have one myself? So our MOQ isn't that high to get clubs involved and then try to increase that amount. So for Tottenham, for example, last year, we did this very cool collaboration with them and Nike around Earth Day. It was a workshop in the stadium with kids and players. Eric Dier was there, a couple of the players from both men and women's team. And then we had this bespoke collection of items to showcase. That's the very first step into the world of upcycling. People of the club were there, retail was there, communication, PR was there, and Nike was there, was involved and on board. And then people get it. And then we can up the ante and go for, you know, a full blown collection. And so we try to be as accessible as possible to get people involved. And then on the other side, is there a maximum? Of course there is. But then if you, for example, 500 pieces would be ready in 2-3 weeks because it's locally made. So we can really be very flexible in that. So if we take 8 weeks, you got 2000 pieces or 2500 pieces. And also, that network will help us with an overflow of, if there's one production facility that's full in Europe, the mainland, we can then move to Porto or to France. And hopefully in England, we'll find another studio close by or in Manchester the next year. So we have also that option there.
Yeah, you've got the north and south covered. So in terms of taking the raw materials, but raw product, essentially, the dead stock, how many, I'm trying to ask this in the simplest way, how many football shirts go into a sports bag or a hold all, or is it not that straightforward? Is it which bits of it?
It is. No, it is. It's a sports bag. If you've got an XL jersey, it's one. If it's less, it's one and a half. a laptop sleeve is medium or bigger, a bum bag is a kid's size jersey or bigger. So it's pretty straightforward. And what we often do, for example, for Club Bruges was pretty cool. So they had a kit with a defected logo from Unibet, was not approved. We took that out. We created a collection of laptop sleeves and wash bags and bum bags. But then we had all these sleeves left. And then we then came back to Club Bruges and like, hey, we can make a cap from that. Would you like that? Yeah, let's do it. So then you have the jersey is fully reused into both a collection and then secondly, a cap made from those leftovers with their logo on it. And, you know, so we try to be creative as well to make sure that we have reused that jersey or short or jacket as much as we can.
Yeah, try and use as much of the supplied garments as possible.
And from a commercial point of view, that's for the club and for us, it's an easy upsell, right? So then for them, it's one jersey in, two products out. It's commercially wise, always a good thing. When we focus on apparel that's defected, they don't hold any commercial value for the club anymore. So that's easy. It same goes for if we use the team worn stuff. So all the training apparel from last season, it's the free of charge product in those kit deals. If you go to retail and you're talking about returned apparel from retail, that's a more difficult discussion because it's often still in the books as, you know, wholesale value. And if you have to take that into account and then try to sell it, then it's a very difficult financial discussion.
Yeah, you need to wait for write-offs from the finance team and all sorts of things. So it can be a lot longer down the line. But no, I understand that kind of coming out of the pro side of the business, it really has zero value because, again, for listeners that don't or haven't worked on the inside of sports within commercial kit supply contracts, there's always an element or very often an element of gift of kit. So kit, which is essentially has zero cost, but usually is utilized for the first team environment and the professional environments gifted by the manufacturer brand partner alongside obviously the commercial value of the wider kit deal. A couple of final questions. The first one, just around challenges. Every new business faces lots of challenges, every young business. And I'm sure you've kind of jumped a lot of hurdles and you've gone through a lot of thought-provoking challenges at times. What would you say the biggest challenges that you've faced in terms of the service, operation and the products that you offer? Is it education? Is that the biggest challenge or are there operational challenges as well?
Yeah, I think education, maybe no, because we can influence that quite well. So if you go to conferences, if we make sure we get speaking and presentation options at the right conferences where stakeholders are, I think we can manage to put a spotlight on what we do within the theme of sustainability. I think production is a big one. You know, we went through a whole journey of Romania, Turkey, Spain before we landed Portugal because, you know, there's not a studio that already makes it and said, well, I'm making bags. Send me a jersey. I'll wrap the bag with a jersey and you're done. It's not the way it goes, especially because we have our own requirements on own designs, circularity and that kind of stuff. But now we have those three studios in place. We've got our tech packs. It becomes easier because now you can send your tech pack. So it's exactly the way the product needs to be made, the pattern, the accessories that goes into it. And if there's a prospective studio we have, that's the information they start with, which was, of course, earlier that was from scratch. Like, hey, I've got an idea. This is my sketch. Can you help? I think that's one. From that side, we're hopefully crossing the pond to the US pretty soon. But that's difficult because it's a long way from home. So I'm traveling to Brighton and Portugal and Rotterdam is easy. To, in this case, Los Angeles is more challenging and more expensive and also less sustainable. So we tried to set up shop there. It's more difficult, but we're getting there. So that's good. And I think another challenge, which is not a challenge, but well, it's a challenge, but and I think we can manage is getting the brands on board. So when you go to a brand, Nike, Adidas, Puma, Macron, Yoma, doesn't matter. They are busy with one, creating new product and putting it into the market. And two, sustainability is mainly focused, mainly on the production process and being more sustainable in making the actual product. So less waste, less water, less chemicals. And that's where, of course, roughly 80% of their impact can be. But then there's a very gray areas, who is responsible for the end of life? Because it's a co-branded product. It's Nike and the Dutch FA, but who owns the product? And the fun part is if we come up and we start the conversation, it's interesting to see that a club often says, well, it's the branded product from brand A, B, or C. If we talk to them, well, no, the club is, it's there, you know.
They ordered it.
Yeah, exactly. So that's really not always taking the right responsibility in owning it. But we also see that clubs and brands come on board. But you can imagine if, for example, Adidas says yes to, let's work together with FC 88 on club A, then club B, C, and D also will come. So they are very careful in saying yes, in saying let's go, in saying you're our upcycling partner, because then that means something for the whole business, their whole business. But I think, you know, we want to be the upcycle partner of the brands. Our impact will be biggest if we work directly for the brands across clubs and federations, because I know those warehouses are full of old product as well.
Yeah, they could be a very powerful chess piece in this game, couldn't they? It's getting the brands on board is, you know, the catalyst, and the explosion that could come from that would be huge on every aspect, you know, both for you as a business, but also for the whole kind of branded sports apparel industry as well.
And we get a lot of questions around, aren't you afraid that they are going to do it themselves? And to be honest, maybe it's not sensible to say that now, but I'm fully behind it. I don't think so, because their core business is, of course, on that producing new apparel, new techniques, more sustainable product. And of course, also the textile recycling step, which would be a great one for us, but also a scary one for us potentially. But it's still so young. The market in recycling is still so new, and upcycling as well, that before we cross that hurdle, we're, I think, 5 to 10 years down the line, and we'll see where we're then.
Yeah, absolutely. And my last question, just before we wrap up, is one around potentially helping the people that are listening to this episode. So I'm sure a lot of people have resonated and related to a lot of what you've been talking about, and are possibly looking to kind of explore the opportunity more. So how can clubs or brands or federations, whatever it may be, how can they kind of keep track of what you're doing? Where can they follow you? And how do they get in touch if they want to find out more?
Yeah. I think we're very active on LinkedIn, of course, mainly focused B2B. So for us, it's a very good outlet to showcase what we do, but also educate, like you mentioned. So please do add me on LinkedIn, find FC88 there. We're more than willing to put a spotlight on what we do to educate you and to help you educate colleagues. So that's, I think, one. We're on Instagram, and that channel more of a B2C focus. Still quite new for us. We've got a lot of requests from fans wanting to upcycle directly with us. So I think that's something we're going to explore the next quarter, to see if fans can send in their own kit and then we're upcycling it for them. So yeah, follow us. I think LinkedIn and Instagram will be the main. You'll see the cool items we make and also how they work from a commercial point of view. And then myself, please do give me a message on Nicole at thisisfc88.com if you want to know more. More than willing to help out.
Superb. I'm sure you'll be getting plenty of contact, whether it be direct or through LinkedIn. It's definitely a really interesting feed, and one that I've enjoyed kind of keeping an eye on what you're doing. I mean, you had some, I know it was like super niche and you never do it, but some super cool Super Bowl bits with the sports hold all and the really nice tote bag that you did on there as well. So yeah, just anybody that's interested in merchandise as a whole, this is a whole new spin on merchandise, and the LinkedIn feed and the Instagram definitely give you some food for thought in terms of product. And yeah, you'll enjoy looking at what FC88 are creating. So thanks so much for your time, Nicole. It's been a really great deep dive into the insight behind not only the problem, the concept and the operation of what you're driving. I think it's admirable. I think it gives clubs and brands, federations, a fantastic opportunity to do more. I think the realization of your opportunity needs to be kind of realized a little bit more. I'm sure you would welcome that. But yeah, anybody that wants to kind of understand more, really understand what a partnership can look like, obviously reach out to Nicole. Nicole will be tagged in all of our social media publicity around this episode. So follow those tags and reach out and start the conversation. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you for jumping in and rescuing us, because we were in a bit of a pickle with this episode and you came on very, very short notice in a week that I know is very busy for you. So I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Leah. Thank you so much for having me. I love listening to the podcast, listened to all the episodes before. So honored to be here as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Yeah, that was really cool, Matt. I really enjoyed that one. A new topic for us. We've not really deep dived into before, and it certainly threw up a lot more than I was expecting it to, in terms of kind of not only broadening my knowledge, but just new opportunities there as well. The whole B2B thing I'd never really thought about.
Definitely. Really interesting. I think you kind of cast your mind back over some of our previous episodes and you can kind of see how it would intertwine with some of the things they're doing as well. I think it's a really innovative way of thinking, and yeah, fair play for the business that they've built already on this.
Yeah, definitely. I can see it growing and growing over the next few years as clubs become a little bit more switched on and attentive to it. As Nicole mentioned there, she's had some conversations 2 or 3 years ago where people are then coming back to her and realizing that as much as they kind of brushed it under the carpet at that stage or kind of put it to the back of their mind, it is actually now something that they want to talk about. And, you know, those people are now coming out of the woodwork to kind of contact her to re-engage, to say, yeah, you know, we've identified this is a problem that we need to find a solution to. And what you presented to us a few years ago is perfect for that solution. So, yeah, fantastic. I want to thank Nicole as well for jumping in and really helping us out at late notice. We kind of ran into a bit of an issue with this episode. So thanks to Nicole for stepping up really late notice and fitting us into a really busy week for her as well. So do appreciate that. If any clubs out there want to contact Nicole, obviously you've got her contact details at the end of the episode there. I really recommend that you kind of drop an email or reach out on social just to start to engage and kind of have that conversation, because I do genuinely think that this is an opportunity for all clubs, regardless of size. Everybody runs into an issue with dead stock and overstock at the end of a season, or a kit change, or a kit brand change, as Nicole was referring to. Let's see what we can do in terms of pairing clubs and FC88 together.
Definitely. And I think you already alluded to it a couple of times, Lee, but this is a business that's going to develop massively over the next couple of years. There's kind of almost one for us to put in our diaries to speak to her again in the future and just kind of find out how things have evolved and kind of where the world's taken it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's one that we'll both be keeping a keen eye on, I would imagine. Anyway, that's the end of episode 2. Another one in the bag, which always feels good. And I guess we'll see you soon for episode 3, Matt.
Yeah, thanks very much. Good to speak to you again.
Yeah, and you, mate. See you later.
Bye.